podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hello, everyone. I am Ben Johnson, and this is the Perpetual Chess Podcast. Perpetual Chess is a weekly interview show where top chess players, authors, content creators, and accomplished amateurs discuss their careers and share stories and chess improvement tips. Perpetual Chess is a part of the Blue Wire Podcast Network, and we'd like to give special thanks to our presenting chess education sponsor, Chessable.com. For more information about the show, you can go to perpetualchesspod.com. But without further ado, let's get to the show. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to a FIDE Candidates 2022 bonus edition of Perpetual Chess. We are recording this here after round 12, and Grandmaster Jan Nepomniachtchi is in a commanding position. At the conclusion of round 12, he leads by a clear 2 points. He has 8.5 out of 12. 8.5 is often enough to win it historically. And behind him, with 6.5 points, are Hikaru Nakamura and Ding Liren. With 6 points, half a point behind them, are Timur Rajabov and Fabiano Caruana. And then with 5 points, we have Richard Rapport and Jan Krzysztof Duda. And then with 4.5 points in last place, as everyone predicted, we have Alireza Firouzja, the young phenom, with a baptism by fire. In terms of the probabilities of what's likely to happen, I probably don't need to tell you guys, Nepo's probably going to win. When we come back for round 13 on Sunday, he will have white against Richard Rapport. That game, he will likely go for a draw. So our friend of the pod, Ty Prue Simmons, chess by the numbers model, has Jan at 99.9% to win the tournament. It might even be higher in reality, because I don't see why Rapport would fight for a win when Nepo goes for a draw, and all he needs is a draw to clinch. Now, of more interest is the battle for second place. And the battle for second place, of course, could take added import this year, because if Magnus does not play, the second place finisher may play Nepo for the World Championship. And of course, we will be discussing all of these things with my guest co-host, who I'll be introducing momentarily. But in Ty's model, the second place probabilities have Hikaru Nakamura at 48.2%, Ding Liren at 38.7%, Timur Rajabov at 8.4%, and Fabiano Caruana at 4.6%. And the others basically aren't going to finish in the top two due to Rapport and Firouzja. So that's the lay of the land. We've got a lot of topics to discuss, but let's introduce our guest co-host. He is, of course, a familiar voice to myself as a fan of his Chessable courses and friend of the pod, been on several times. He's an award-winning Chessable author, regular author, opening theoretician. He'll be coming out with the Lifetime Repertoire Triangle Slav, with co-authored with Grandmaster Erwin Lemie. That should be out next week. So let's welcome I.M. Krzysztof Selecki back to the pod. And by the way, we're both doing this from vacation. So Krzysztof, thank you for breaking up your vacation to share your wisdom about this fascinating, if anticlimactic, tournament.
Yeah, Ben, thanks for introducing me and having me on the show. Very happy to join in and discuss probably the most important tournament of the year.
Yeah, most important historical legacy, and one, Krzysztof, that you and I both got wrong. I thought Ding Liren was the most likely to win this tournament. You poo-pooed that notion correctly, but you thought Jan Nepomniachtchi would likely fade down the stretch. Of course, there has been that narrative in the past. I understand where you were coming from. But Krzysztof, so I'll talk about what I think I got wrong, but what do you think you got wrong about this tournament as we think back?
Yeah, I was thinking before the tournament, I was thinking that Fabiano Caruana would be the favorite in my mind. Of course, it is obviously tough to predict, but I was thinking he's more likely to be the winner compared to Ding, because I think the circumstances for Ding were not that great, like the travel from China. It's very difficult. He had problems getting visa for the qualification process. He was very late in Madrid, like jet lagging and so on. It didn't feel right to me. And he had a bad start. I mean, he got into the groove later and had a very bad game today, but he had a very good stretch in the three rounds before. So Ding kind of got into it. And I wasn't totally wrong about Fabiano's. He started very well, but then he did the Nepo, so to say, and mm-hmm. completely crumbled in the last couple of rounds. I'm also surprised that Nepo is kind of so dominant in this tournament. However, if you look at the games, and I looked at them during the day, I mean, I looked at the games when they were played during the rounds, but I did kind of a recap today for me. And it's really kind of staggering how many opportunities were given to him more or less on a silver plate. This is not something to, this is not diminishing, if that's the right word, his play, or I don't want to say he didn't play well. He played very well, in fact, in conversion of all those games. But some of the games were really, very one-sided in a way that the opponents played one or two pretty awful moves, and then he exploited them perfectly, of course. But in tournaments where he did falter after some rounds, he sometimes got into situations where he was a little bit too, what is the right word there? Yeah? A little bit careless, maybe, yeah, in his conversion, and that didn't happen at all. He was very, 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 very straightforward in converting the advantages and didn't make many mistakes at all. However, I see one game as very important, and that is the game that he managed to draw at the end against Fabiano, because at one point, like by computer standards, he was lost, really completely lost. He would have lost it against an engine, but well, man, these human beings, right? They're not computers. And Fabiano didn't find the right move there. It's this crucial moment when he took with the bishop on f5 and instead could have played bishop f1, a move that was, however, pointed out in the live broadcast, yeah, I think by Judith Polgar and Jan Gustafsson, even without the help of a computer, yeah, they figured out that this move is correct. So it's not total rocket science or total engine chess that nobody can find. And I think this was a really pivotal moment in the tournament. If Caruana wins this game, it's a totally different story in a way. Yeah? I mean, we don't know what would have happened, but I think this is an absolute key game of the tournament.
Yeah, it's funny. I had highlighted that exact same point. That game happened at the conclusion of round two. And yeah, when Magnus went on the Chess24 broadcast, he was a bit critical of Fabiano's decision to take a draw there. Even in the final position, the engine preferred black. And of course, it's easier to say with hindsight. At the time, Fabiano's thinking, okay, I'm black against another of the strongest competitors. I'll be tied for clear first. But as it happened, Nepo's just been relentless. Sam Shanklin, writing for chess.com yesterday, called it an absurdly dominant and powerful performance by Nepo. So I see a lot of people online, and as I discussed with Grandmaster Jonathan Tisdall, you do get the sense that Nepo's opponents are kind of not putting their best feet forward, you could say. They're kind of leading with their face, as Grandmaster Tisdall memorably said. But As you said, Christoph, you've got to take the opportunities given. So I think it's really important to give Nepo full credit and not denigrate his performance in any way. It's been a dominant performance. He's up to number 3 in the world of the live rankings, or at least was before his draw today. And he's showing that his previous, despite the bizarre circumstances of his last candidate's performance, it was not a fluke. And I feel like that's what I got wrong a little bit. I attributed it too much to the circumstances of the match being divided up. And I maybe also what happened with Nepo in the World Championship, where once he lost, maybe his nerves got the better of him. I wasn't sure how much carryover there would be, even though he's played well in subsequent tournaments. And I would say I got wrong the idea that he's just, you know, I maybe underestimated the level of his preparation and confidence against everyone that is not Magnus.
Yeah. Well, one thing though that you have to see is that usually, if you look at the history of the candidates tournament, it's very, very rare that a player wins it without losing a game. That's really rare. Over the 14 games, if you look at this particular format, they almost always had one loss, even two sometimes. Yeah, when Magnus won it, for example, he lost two games even, but won enough to compensate for that. And Nepo didn't lose a game, and you don't know what would have happened if he would have lost one. Yeah, and kind of had this this break. I mean, it's well known that if he's running hot, he can play extremely well and everything goes his way. But then if this kind of moment of this bad moment arrives and he loses one, then everything can crumble, which never happened. It simply never happened. In those critical moments, it kind of went well for him. But one thing that really should be said, like if you look at the sheer numbers, right, he's got 8.5 points, which is usually, as you said, the winning score. Right. And there's still two games to go. So it's plus five is fantastic. Yeah? It's a really, really excellent performance. And we should be, as you already said, yeah, it's really, really something to be proud of. Yeah. From his point of view, very, very good tournament.
Yeah, and we've got lots more to talk about with regard to this tournament. Of course, there's still two rounds to go, so there's still lots to be determined. So here are the topics Christoph and I are going to hit, and then, of course, I'll be back for more candidates coverage. I believe it's on July 12th with Grandmaster David Howell. We'll do one last wrap-up when it's all over, and maybe by then we'll even have some news about what's happening with the World Championship cycle. But here's the five topics I want to hit with Christoph. Number one, the battle for second place, of course, taking out an import this year. Number two, the controversy surrounding Alireza and his tilted bullet match with Danya and his general form in the tournament. Number three, as we record this, Naka had a quick draw today that basically clinched it for Nepo and eliminated Naka from winning it. And there's been a bit of discussion about that decision, so Christoph and I will talk about that. Number four, the quality of play. There was a noteworthy quote from former world champion Vladimir Kramnik fairly early in the tournament, judging the quality of the play of these participants harshly. And number five, let's just talk a little bit about Magnus's plans and whether he could possibly enticed by a change of world championship format. So we're going to try to fit this all in an hour or less, lots to discuss. And first, we're going to take a break and hear from our sponsors.
Perpetual Chess is brought to you in part by aimchess.com. My latest discovery on aimchess.com is, in addition to its algorithm generating statistics and telling you trends from your opening games, there's a tab at the top where you can go to game history and review individual games, and it tags recurring issues. So for example, it keeps telling me I had good openings, but it also tells me when I was behind on the clock, when I failed to convert an advantage. So you can then, within the Aim Chess platform, review the game and look for leaks that you need to plug, things to correct. So one of the many ways you can use aimchess.com to improve your game. So you can check it out for free. And if you choose to subscribe, use the code perpetual30 to save 30%, or you can also use the link on aimchess.com that is provided in the show description.
And we are back. And so we led with Nepo, but following Nepo, Christoph, I think the most important thing is the actual standings. Of course, we have a tense battle for second place. Hikaru Nakamura and Ding Liren with 6.5 points again, and Timur Rajabov, surprisingly to me, and Fabiano with 6. So who would you most like to see if we were going to assume that Magnus is going to decline the match and there will in fact be a world championship or faux world championship between Nepo and one of these people? Who would you most like to see him play, Christoph?
Who's not saying Hikaru there?
Exactly. It's got to be Hikaru.
That's kind of a bit of a non-question, even though certainly people very deservedly could be fans of Ding or the other players for sure. But I think in terms of spectacle, it's kind of clear that Hikaru would be the one to hope for. There also would be some matches if we just speculate. It's all speculation, of course, because we don't know what's going to happen. Yeah, Magnus might just play Nepo, and it's just like every single time. It's nothing special, and it doesn't happen. But if we have first and second place playing, there could be some matches which would be pretty difficult, I think, to even see how they would take place, under which circumstances they should take place. Just imagine like a match between Rajabov and Nepo. What kind of a match is that?
Yeah.
Where would they play it? In Baku or what is that? That's very difficult. And it's, I think, very difficult to market like in the West, because, it's a very unattractive match. I mean, let's be honest there. For all kinds of reasons. So I do hope that Nakamura finishes second, I think he's got a slightly better tiebreak, right? So his chances are a little bit better than than Dings, but they have a game in the final round, which is, of course, very, very exciting.
Yeah, yeah, that could be potentially huge. Ding with the white pieces against Nakamura. One thing we should mention, FIDE, to their credit, as I mentioned in the candidates preview, they did put in a contingency for a playoff if there was a tie for first. But, you know, in their infinite wisdom, it was hard to foresee every scenario where now we feel like we need a playoff for second. And in fact, Ding Liren in his post-game interview with Dina Belankaya yesterday said maybe they can organize an action playoff or something if there's a tie for second. So he's hoping that that might change. I mean, he might have been aware that Hikaru has slightly better tie breaks, but it's probably too late to change it now. It's probably wishful thinking. But he'll have white against Hikaru. So if nothing unexpected happens in the 13th round, none of the four people who are in main contention for second place play each other. But as you said, Christoph, in the 14th round, they play each other. And again, and I agree with you, to me, none of these matches would feel like a world championship, but I do consider Nakamura and Nepo to be a very compelling matchup in its own right. So that could at least be entertaining. And Nepomniachtchi and Caruana, I would also find interesting. I'm a big Ding fan, but under the circumstances of the, I don't know, I've just been a little disappointed with his performance here. So I wouldn't be as excited for that match. And as you say, Rajabov, Nepo, it wouldn't be my first choice. And I don't think it would be a lot of fans' first choice. With all due respect to these fantastic players, Rajabov with a quite surprising victory today with the black pieces. But yeah, it'll be a tense battle for second place, and we'll just have to see what happens and then see how the stories unfold. On to the second controversy. I guess you could definitely call this one a controversy. Alireza Faruja. So before we get to the famed blitz bullet match with Grandmaster Naroditsky, what do you think has gone wrong for him, Christoph?
Yeah, that's really a bit of a mystery, right? Because it wasn't to be expected that he's doing so poorly. I mean, I didn't have him as one of the top favorites because I felt that the lack of experience in this particular, the super high level events. I mean, you have to be very honest there. How many of those super high levels event has he actually played? I think he has played like two Tata Steel tournaments. He didn't play, is it even two? I think he played in 2020. And 2021. Yeah, so he played two, but he didn't play this year because of some, they didn't get it, couldn't get it going with the organizers. I didn't skip that one. And he played and won very strong the open event, this Grand Swiss, to qualify, but he didn't win any of those super strong tournaments. And I think it's very helpful to have this experience. The tournament is very long, those 14 rounds. And experience counts for a lot, I think, in this circumstance. Also, I feel some of his decisions just look like he's rusty. Eh? I mean, he hasn't played much, and this seems to be really a factor. And some decisions are really weird. If you look at the games, I mean, did you look at the game against Hikaru a little bit more closely?
Yeah. Which one was that?
That was the Sicilian, where he played a very early G takes F6, and he took a huge strategic risk with black against Hikaru.
Yeah.
But that was a kind of a decision that was, it's probably objectively not good in the first place. But if you play in that risky fashion, and he's not alien to that, yeah, he's a very sharp and very enterprising player, you simply cannot afford any misstep. And if you're not in really top shape, those missteps cost like tons of games. And you see that happen all the time. He's taking very risky decisions or in bad decisions if you are very, very critical. And then followed up, you cannot follow it up with precise calculation. And this is then leading to this disaster, right? That it now is for him, for sure. I mean, he's 18 years old, right?
19. 19 now.
Yeah.
Yeah, and yeah, I mean, that game with the Hikaru in round 10 may be the one that led to the circumstances that really put him on tilt, air quotes, you know, because as a lot of listeners probably heard, he was up till 6 a.m. The night after that, and that was the night where he was, you know, it never looked good for him after the first few rounds, but that's when it's 100%. Okay, you're not winning this tournament, and that's when he stayed up till 6 a.m. playing a 250 game bullet match with Grandmaster Naroditsky. And then yesterday, round against Nepomniachtchi, he just played a bad game. I mean, for listeners who saw the game, he played this g4 idea opening the king side, just total suicidal idea against Nepo, and Nepo just like brushed it off effortlessly there in round 11. So again, Nepo's taking his chances, but yeah, I mean, it seems like Ali Reza is learning a lot of tough lessons this tournament. I think, and Danya Naroditsky, for when I tuned into the chess.com broadcast, I was quite eloquent saying like, this will be a building block for Ali Reza. He will rise again, but it seems like sometimes you just have to, you know, it's been pointed out prior to this tournament, someone like Grandmaster Robert Hess, who I interviewed, often you kind of have to, you know, you have to get beaten before you learn how these things work. And that hopefully and likely is the position that Ali Reza finds him in now. Now, Christoph, a lot of people I'm seeing being very judgmental of the mere fact that he stayed up late playing bullet before such an important tournament. Where do you come down on that?
Before I go there, just a very quick fun fact. It's like, of course, I'm in Europe. Yeah, I'm on vacation, still in Europe, in Slovenia, and we have the same time zone as Spain. Yeah, and it was very coincidental that I was up very early that day. I was up like five a.m. because I'm in a place here where you cannot really how do you describe that? You cannot really get the room very dark. Yeah. So if the sun is up, it's just like bright in the room. Yeah. And I woke up at 5 a.m. and I was like just grabbing my mobile. And there was a Twitter post. I think it was Levi Rossman who posted, "What the heck is going on? Why are they playing bullet at 5 a.m. during time?" And I was like tuning this, you know, in Lee Chess. I'm like, what is going on? That's not real, right? And it was real, and it was a discussion afterwards. Yeah, so what's my point there? I mean, okay, he shouldn't do it. That's, I think, pretty clear, right? That this is kind of unprofessional. But on the other hand, you know, I do have some, I kind of understand where it's coming from in a way, because it was certainly very frustrating, the whole thing. And I can imagine that he simply wanted to do something else, just like didn't really want to study anything and like wanted to have a change and maybe just get the mind somewhere totally different. And I can easily imagine that under other circumstances, like other people or in different times, also would have done something totally unprofessional, like getting drunk till 4 in the morning, but nobody would have noticed it, right? And here it's just happening like on a public account and everybody can see it. And I think there have been plenty of those unprofessional moments, even by more experienced players in other situations nobody knows of or could have known of. And now everybody has seen that he played there. I think it would be pretty clear to him that it wasn't such a good idea. It's a learning experience. An interesting thing that I would like to know, and I have no clue about, if he's got some kind of advisor, like an older, more experienced player who's helping him with decisions like that. Obviously, there wouldn't somebody sitting in the hotel room in the morning like, you shouldn't play bullet here, but like just some kind of mentor or something. That would be, I think, something that a young player would be very helped with, right? Do you know if he's got somebody there?
Well, it's been rumored / vaguely reported that working on his team have been Ivan Chaparinov, of course, noted opening theoretician, and Grandmaster Kramnik, believe it or not, the critic of the candidates himself. Now, in terms of who's there with him, I heard it mentioned that his brother and his dad are there with him. I haven't heard about another sort of father figure type chess player. But I wanted to make the exact same point about you that people do irresponsible things. People, when they're faced with adverse circumstances, look for ways to blow off steam. And it's just that it's a little more public than it would be in years mm-hmm. past. So I'm with you there. Another thing to point out, I mean, yes, he was up till 6 a.m., but his game was till 3 p.m. His game is until 3 p.m. Spain time, if I'm not mistaken, Christoph.
That's true. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's not ideal. I mean, I would say, honestly, if he was playing till 3 a.m., to me, it's zero issue, zero. The fact that 6 a.m., okay, people are going to criticize him, you know, but honestly, I think if anything, I'm sympathetic. Again, he's 19. You know, when I was 19, I was just studying or getting drunk in college, you know, like, and I think that's more common. If this is the biggest mistake in his life, he'll be quite okay. But still, nonetheless, a disappointing performance. And Jan Gustafsson did raise a good point that there's the unfortunate circumstance, and I know you've been critical of the format of the FIDE candidates. Mm-hmm. You would prefer a match format. I know my friend Greg Shahadi would as well. There's the unfortunate circumstance that if you do something irresponsible that scuttles your own chances, there are other people sort of caught in the crosshairs, as it were, because like your loss, Nepo's win, then adversely impacts everyone else chasing Nepo.
We're in a situation in this tournament that it doesn't really matter all that much anymore. Yeah, if people like, I mean, I'm not saying gifted the point to him, but I mean, Nepo was clearly helped by Alireza's weak play in this game, but he's so far away from the rest of the field that you could argue that it doesn't even matter all that much. Yeah, that half.
Yeah, I mean, Yeah, I was just going to say, the moment you highlighted from round two where Fabiano didn't press for a win with black, like, to me, that's how far back you have to go to really have one moment to change things.
Round nine, of course, yeah? The white game where you had this bishop f1, that was a very key moment also.
Which opponent was that one?
The white game. Fabiano with white against Nepo.
He had
very good position if he would have played bishop f1.
I take back what I said. I forgot about that. Yeah, Fabiano really. Mm. I mean, that was one of those computers screaming at moments. It's a bit of a tricky move, but Fabiano was playing so well up to that moment that I thought he was going to find it, and he didn't.
Mm. And the broadcasts Judit found it pretty quickly. And you get there. I mean, it's much easier if you're not sitting there. It's always the same thing. But that was, I think, a huge disappointment also for Fabiano, because there was a huge chance to get really in fight for first place. We're not talking about second place, but for first place at this moment. And with that gone, I think that also contributed to the fact that he lost, I think, two more games to Ding and to Duda, right? Yeah, and that there was, a key moment there.
Yeah. Well, on to topic number three, which is Nakamura had black against Nepomniachtchi today, kind of potential last gasp for him, but it was a Berlin draw. So again, I've seen some criticism online. I think especially for newer chess fans, it can be tough to understand why Naka would do this. Could you give your perspective? So again, by conceding this draw with black, Naka basically admits he's not going to catch Nepo. What did you think of this decision, Christoph?
Yeah, I actually expected exactly the same game. Or you can also make a draw with five rookie one there, which is not like the perpetual, but like a super dull position that also nobody's going to lose with white. I did watch Nakamura's video where he explained his rationale behind accepting the draw in a way, or allowing this draw. And I think it makes perfect sense. I mean, the chances, even if you kind of construct a win for Hikaru, which is very difficult to achieve in the first place, he doesn't really have great chances to fight for first place even then. And the risk to go there is extremely high with black against 1e4. And I think if you look at his opening repertoire, he is very much a specialist. Hikaru is on the double king pawn openings, this Berlin. This is like his forte. And what else is he going to play? I mean, he's not, I mean, of course he can play something like some Sicilian, as he suggested, or as he showed some examples of in his video. But I completely understand where he's coming from. And it would have been a totally different thing, of course, if second place would be irrelevant. But it could be very relevant. And I think that was a very clear decision. And I completely understand what he's doing. And he was kind of, I think, very understanding in the video less experienced chess fans could have trouble understanding what's going on. And I totally agree. Yeah, that's a bit difficult to understand. But I think it makes total sense.
Yeah, I'm with you all the way. I also expected this result. And I definitely recommend, if any listeners haven't checked out Hikaru's 10-minute recap explaining his rationale and pointing out some historical analogs where Black pushed too hard for wins in similar situations. Anish Giri himself tweeted as a reply to someone, if White wants to make a draw out of the opening, for Black to avoid that, one has to play some bad opening, often that he hasn't prepared up front, and thus take serious risks impacting your expected value very negatively. His fellow super grandmasters definitely understand. And it was interesting in Hikaru's video, because he and Caruana have both said they still expect Magnus to defend the title. I'm a little less optimistic. I hope I'm wrong. But he said, even though he thinks Magnus is going to play the match, he has to put into the calculus the elevated probability of a match against number two. All right, Christoph, we got to take one more break and then get to hot topics number 4 and 5 on the agenda, which are the quality of play and potential altering formats to try to entice Magnus. We'll be right back.
Perpetual Chess is proud to be brought to you in part by Chessable.com, the leading chess education platform. Chessable, of course, uses its proprietary move trainer technology, which has spaced repetition to help you learn opening sequences, tactical patterns, basic end games, all of which it will quiz you on repeatedly until you have it down cold. They have courses both for free and for purchase. One of their newest includes the Beginner's 1D4 Repertoire by popular and entertaining YouTube commentator and streamer, I am Andras Toth. So if you're just looking to get your feet wet in an opening, it is a great intro. And of course, they also have intermediate classics like Endgame Strategy and tons of advanced opening courses that you can check out for free or for purchase at chessable.com.
And we are back. And as we said, our next topic is quality of play. Now, full caveat, as a lowly 2100, I feel like I have to tread very carefully judging these super GMs, but I'll just read Kramnik's quote. Number one, Kramnik says, and we should say this was after round 5 or 6, an interview given on Ilya Levitov's YouTube channel, where he had Kramnik join him for a Russian broadcast for a while. And it was picked up by Chess24, I believe it was Tarje Svensson. So you can read a summary of what Kramnik said, and we'll try to drop a link to that, although we're going to get this out quickly. Kramnik said, I have never seen so many bad games in a top-level tournament. I'm very interested to know as to why this is. Blunders happen time to time in top-level chess, but in this tournament, they aren't episodic. The sheer amount of unreasonable mistakes of all types is stunning, and I want you, the YouTube audience, to discuss with me as to what exactly changed in the chess world in the last few years. I hope I have earned my right to be critical of the players in question, and I want you to know that I'm not trying to humiliate any of them. Rather, I'm just being honest in analyzing their games. These players are capable of some really high-level quality chess, but this exact tournament does seem to have more bad games than ever. Now, again, that was only after round 5 or 6, but if we look at something like Ali Reza's performance against Nepo in round 11 yesterday, I would say the possible criticism could extend. Christoph, mm-hmm. You're significantly more qualified to discuss this than I am. What have you thought about the quality of play?
Yeah, I also would have been I would have a hard time to say they're playing like 2300s. That would also be very, very tough thing to say for an international master, because the players are obviously much more stronger than I am. But Kramnik has a bit of a point. I mean, this is not wrong. It's not a really great quality of play. You can add in, as you mentioned, Ali Reza game with White against Nepo, which was a bit crazy. I mean, the G4H4 plan was really a bit out of this world. And it's not, you don't need a computer to see that it's wrong. Really yeah. not. I mean, and I think
he played G4 and Nepo, like with the idea presumably of advancing the pawn, and Nepo prevented it with H6, you know, textbook stuff. And then he thought for 25 minutes. I mean, it just shows a kind mm-hmm. of, it shows his head wasn't in the right space to be so surprised by the most obvious prophylactic reply. But anyway, I'm sorry I cut you off, Christoph.
Yeah, and we also have had this game today, which was, I think, it sounds harsh, but the game that Ding played with White today against Rajabov was a very weird game. I mean, he lost without any chance at all in like 26 moves with White. That was very weird. And Rajabov didn't need to do anything great. I mean, he had a high sacrifice on E3. It was a nice move. But what on earth did Ding in the opening with White? That was really strange. So I think Kramnik is not wrong. The level of play isn't great. But the interesting question is really, what is the reason? And I mean, I think Kramnik is kind of implying that, I think what he's implying is that the rise of online chess and kind of less practice in over-the-board play and longer time controls plays a role. That could be. That's definitely not out of the question. However, I think one thing that could be a point is that I think in some games, players try to sort of force the issue by sharpening up the game in positions where it's not really warranted. Yeah, this is kind of a thing that you see in some games. If you think about, for example, Fabiano lost with Black against Duda. If you remember that game, he had Black in a slow Italian, and all of a sudden started this g5 h5 play on the king side when the knight was offside on a5. And I think it was clearly motivated by this desire to win somehow, but it was pretty unobjective to do that. It wasn't a good plan. And you have some more examples of that, this kind of maybe over ambitious play or so. And I sometimes wonder if this is due to maybe this idea that let's say if you play in a more normal or more solid fashion, it's going to be drawish or a draw, right? So I think sometimes they try a little bit too hard to do something when there's nothing there. And this is also a bit of a quality that Nepo has in this tournament. He's not doing anything special, really. He's being very solid, very, very sober in his play, and he takes all those opportunities presented to him by overambitious and kind of weird play. Another example that also Kramnik didn't see already when he made a statement is Report's White game against Nepo, which was really also a pretty crazy thing to happen.
Oh, yeah.
If you remember that game, it was really kind of strange, even though I looked at it and again today, and I have to say that the weirdest thing about this game is, I mean, people really would have to check it and look it up to understand what I'm talking about. But the weirdest thing is that this opening variation that he went for is extremely well known that it is a forced draw. Yeah, and then he avoided the draw and was worse. And
much worse, yeah.
Much worse. However, one thing that, I mean, did you ever look at the position? Like,
I remember the game, yeah.
If you look at the position, right, and you don't, you absolutely want to win the game, yeah? You don't want to make a draw. Then you play this, and I know it, in my mind, from a human perspective of an IM, I would think, okay, maybe I'm a little bit worse with White, but I'm not lost, and I don't want to make a draw. Then I could see myself playing it. I mean, the engine immediately says, oh, God, this is complete garbage. It's lost and so on. But this is just the engine. That's not a human player. So I do have some I kind of understand where Report was coming from when he made the decision to play on because he simply didn't want to draw. The weird thing is that when he starts this opening play, the first 9-10 moves, this is all known. So
yeah,
and this is so strange, yeah, that he's going for this line where he should know that either he's drawing or he's clearly worse, as the computer then shows. This is very mysterious, and there are some more of those mysterious moments in this event, yeah, like Ding's game today. Like, what was he doing there in the opening? It was really, really strange. Yeah?
Yeah. And the game you refer to, the rapport Nepo game, Fabiano Caruana in his post-game interview was just like, I couldn't believe what I was seeing. And usually he's a little, he chooses his words somewhat carefully in some cases, but in this case, he said the same thing you did. Everyone knows that that's a drawing line, and I couldn't believe. So, I mean, it's like layers of shock because he didn't know the position. And then from there, he, like you say, if you take the decision to press for a win in isolation, it makes sense. But when you layer it on top of not knowing this line that players of that level all know for the most part, so it doesn't come out looking great. So
it's very strange, but I think it would be very interesting to think about this a little bit deeper. Yeah, what Kramnik said, that the level of play is not great. I think what is very important to consider is, if you look at the games, there are different ways to look at them. You can look at them always having this computer on. And if you do that, you will find tons of mistakes in every tournament, like in every tournament. And in particular, if you take very modern engines like Stockfish 15 or 14.1, they have these evaluation functions that give very high evaluations, sometimes like +2 or even more, in positions that might warrant this evaluation, but they're very high, and they are not that high if humans play the positions. Like, I mean, you can see that one side maybe is better, but you sometimes completely you think, oh, that was a huge blunder, and it wasn't really a huge blunder. Just like the computers are so deep in their calculation and their evaluation that they kind of overstate in a way how many mistakes there are. And that's very important to understand. A different thing is, however, if you look at the games, and as a strong player like Kramnik can easily say, wow, this move makes absolutely no sense. Yeah, and sometimes even like when you said like g4, h4, what Alireza played, that makes no sense. And this is the thing, when you as a human immediately identify, that is a bad move, and then the computer just says, well, yeah, it's a bad move, and then you can be very critical, I think. You have to be a bit careful with stating, oh, they're playing badly, if you just look at the evals. I mean, I know that you know that as well, but many people just say, oh, yeah, the engine is just going up and down, they have to be very bad players. That's not the case. In particular, if you take these modern engines, which have these very high evaluation counts, let's say.
Yeah, that's an important point. And it's so easy to sit at your engine and criticize the moves. So we want to couch it carefully that that's not what Kramnik is doing. And there have just been some uncharacteristic mistakes.
And there have been also some very good games, by the way. Yeah, like, I mean, I liked, for example, I mean, this game had some mistakes, but it was a very tense and interesting game. Hikaru's win with White against Fabiano was a very nice game, I think.
Yeah, I agree.
That was a very, very complex and interesting game. And there were also certainly some others. Yeah, so it's not like every game is bad or anything like that. But I do understand where Kramnik is coming from in a way. I mean, I wouldn't go so far to be so harsh as he was. But, I mean, he's a former world champion, and I think he can afford this strong of an opinion. Yeah? We have to be a little bit more modest there.
Right, exactly. And the final topic, point number 5 that I wanted to discuss, and as I told you before recording, Christoph, I might be trying to speak this into existence, but I did see some quotes that I'd like to share. So we don't know if Magnus is going to play. Maybe he'll just say, you know what? Nepo's been in great form. I think he'll be a strong competitor. I'll play him after all. Maybe that will happen. But the other thing I'm sort of still hoping is that maybe Magnus, if he doesn't want to play the classical format, can advocate for some sort of change of format. Of course, and he's many times been an advocate of a mixed format with some faster chess thrown in. I personally, and I know a lot of people feel this way, I would prefer a classical match, but if it's going to be either no Magnus and all classical, or Magnus and a mixed format. I would prefer the latter. But anyway, the quotes I wanted to share were Jan Nepomniachtchi yesterday on the chess.com broadcast after round 11, if people want to track it down. He joined them, and they're trying not to ask him every single round about, like, what do you think Magnus is going to do? But he did share, he said, I quote, "I received quite a weird letter from FIDE that proposed change to the format to three sets of matches instead of one long match." So that's interesting in itself. So he didn't mention a change in time controls, but he mentioned the possibility of them breaking the match up into smaller chunks, which I don't know if that would appeal to Magnus. But anyway, the mere fact that they're considering changes, I found that to be encouraging, because again, ideally I would love just another 14-game classical match with Magnus in it. But if that's not going to happen, I want a way to get Magnus involved. And then Maxime Vachier-Lagrave, in an interview with Chessbase that came out within the last day or two, said he understands Magnus's perspective, that he doesn't want to go through another grueling world championship match. But MVL said, and I quote, "I find it a bit weird he doesn't offer another idea or another way to create a world champion or a different cycle that suits him better so that he can take part in it." And I just wanted to second that. I mean, Magnus, you know, he who owns the gold makes the rules. So if Magnus doesn't want to play a slower match, why doesn't he negotiate? So I'm still hoping that as the dust settles, that there may be some room for that. Am I just being hopelessly optimistic, Christoph? What do you think?
I'm not sure about, let's say, the legal side of that. Can they just change the format? Maybe they can. I mean, it's not set in stone that it has to be like classical and 14 games, right? They could still change it, I assume, if this is a discussion at all. And I think it can be a discussion to be had. I mean, as you certainly know, and some others might know who read my tweets or other statements, I'm very open to discussing new formats and ideas in terms of time control and other formats changes. What I think is very interesting and important that we get more opinions on the table. I think it's good to hear from people like MVL or maybe Nepo didn't say anything. He just got this letter, right? He didn't
say
anything.
Yeah, he just kind of, interesting. He didn't really say,
Yeah, but it would be interesting to learn what the opinion of the top players, what they are, what they think about the format. And what I think is very true is that I also think that Magnus should make some kind of suggestion what could be changed or what kind of format he would think to be better. I mean, it's not something that I feel the world champion should be able to force upon the whole thing. That's really wrong. But as a starting point, what do you think would be better? And then you could also get other opinions by players who are possibly involved in the whole thing. And then maybe you can do something that would be better. I think what is largely underestimated by the public is how much effort this match takes, or these matches take, not so much the actual play, which is certainly, as you said, a grueling experience, but also the whole preparation process. And I mean, the thing is, most people don't work on chess the whole day. And if you do that, and I do that usually, currently I'm on vacation, thankfully, but I look at chess the whole day. And if you sometimes think about this, I'm looking for hours and hours, let's say at the Italian game with d3, right? And or the Ruy Lopez with d3, the Berlin with d3, some kind of relatively slowish opening. And they make preparations for those, let's be honest, very slow and not super exciting openings, up to move 20, move 25. The whole ground for fighting is so narrow nowadays. Yeah, I mean, if you look at the top level, if you see people play e4, we are so far that they think you can only play one e5 and maybe like one or two Sicilians. Everything else is just bad, which is, of course, in itself a little bit. Yeah, it can be quite true. I think you could play a Caro or a French or something like that once in a while. But if they are really, really honest about it, they think everything else except for e4, e5 or some Sicilians is bad. And the consequences, they all look at like the Petrov, at the Berlin, all those. It's just a set, very small set of openings. And then in those openings, they have to drill very, very deeply. And just imagine doing that for weeks. Like, yeah. You get crazy. I think you get crazy if you do this all the time. And this is also why I sometimes think it could be an idea like make more games, like allow for more games by shortening the time control.
Exactly.
So that the importance of one game is less and you could risk a little bit more. This is just like what I'm thinking, which would be possible. I just think they feel it is too risky. I mean, just if you think about this, let's say you would one player in such a match would be forced to play the French defense in every game. They would think, the top players would think, that this match is lost.
Right.
It's not even worth playing. And this sounds crazy, but this is what they think. So they are very much focused on this small set of openings, in this small set of kind of structures. And I think it's at one point you certainly get crazy. Yeah. And this is also why I understand in a way that somebody like Ali Reza in this tournament, like he's out of the tournament and after playing badly, and he certainly has prepared for months for this event like crazy. That I mean, other people probably would have just gotten a bottle of whiskey and
right.
Yeah, that's it, right? He decided to play bullet, right? But yeah, you understand what I'm getting at. These matches are not just the 3 weeks, but weeks and weeks and weeks before of preparing. And we are talking about an extremely drawish game where they are kind of trying to find small little things, small little ideas. It's very difficult. I kind of understand why it's very difficult. And this is something that I think needs discussion. Are other formats possible? I think there's a wide range of options for sure. There was a suggestion on Twitter by Jakob Argaard, for example, who had a totally different take. He wanted to replace the whole thing just with one tournament, like no candidates, no match, like one tournament. And it was structured, I think what he proposed was kind of similar to what they did in those Grand Prix tournaments, a smallish round robin, and then you have some people do some quick knockouts to get to a final match. I mean, there are many, many possibilities, and let's just talk about them. And I don't think it's really so much about Magnus playing or not playing, because I don't think the world champion should dictate what the format is. But I think there is concern that it's not going to get any better. Like in those matches. I mean, the preparation and the theory is getting deeper and deeper. And as I said, this battlefield is narrowing. It's narrowing more and more. And I mean, do you want to always see the Petrov and these three Italians and Spanishes? I don't know. I find it boring.
Yeah.
And that's what it's going to be, very likely.
Yeah. Very eloquently said, Christoph. And yeah, and I agree. And I know not everyone listening agrees. Some of you think the format is perfect, and that's respectable. But again, the fact that the world champion, and as Jonathan Tisdall pointed out in our round six update, Magnus has been vocal about this since before he was world champion. This is not like his taking advantage of his position in any way. So I agree with you. But as you said earlier, Christoph, the most important thing is that they interface with the actual top 20 players in the world and see where the consensus is in that regard. Because at the end of the day, those are the people whose opinions should weigh the heaviest. So if there is some consensus, maybe there's some room to rescue a true world championship, because obviously an air quotes world championship without the best player in the world, without the highest rated player in the world, you know, we've been there and done that in chess. And it's not the most entertaining, not the highest form.
And I think we don't really know where the majority of the top players stand on the format. I don't think we know. Or do you have a clear idea, like a majority would want exactly this format? Or I have no clue. I really have no clue what the majority would like to have as a format. And I think it would be good to get an opinion.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of difficult because there are so many variables. You could think about, let's play a match, but with less games, more games, faster time control, whatever. Then you can do many, many things. By the way, the idea that kind of was mentioned, like splitting a match up into sets, this is kind of interesting. Have you thought about that?
A little bit. I mean, I hadn't until Jan shared that quote. Mm-hmm. I think it might help a little bit, but I, of course, would prefer the mixed time control format. But I think mm-hmm. it's a step in the right direction.
Yeah, I think what they might suggest is, and I think this was discussed right after the Nepo match last year, it was something like they would play, let's say, I'm just... details could be different, but something like they would play like four games, and if those four games would end in like would end even like 2-2, like four draws, for example, then they would make a tiebreaker for this set. So one side would be in the lead, and then there would be a second set, and then the other side would have to strike back to get to even sets. And this is kind of interesting because I think the incentive to play for a win would come earlier.
Oh yeah, that sounds good.
I didn't think this is a bad idea. Like, I haven't thought about it for hours, but I just find it interesting to discuss this a little bit, and maybe you find some way to tweak it that most people would agree that it is a positive thing. Sometimes you just have to change some little thing, and it has a pretty big impact. For example, if you want to take one thing that definitely, I think, was a good change, that they got rid of the increments before move 60.
Yeah,
I think that was a very good decision. And this is something that wasn't done. I mean, they could have done it years ago. And now they do it, and everyone says, oh, this is a good thing. Why haven't they done this before? So sometimes even relatively small changes can have big impacts. And why not tweak the existing thing maybe just a little bit if you cannot go so far to, like, okay, make it faster, whatever. Yeah, I mean, a revolution is sometimes difficult to explain to a large amount of people, but maybe you can do little things that still would help, yeah? Somewhat would be
Agreed.
Interesting.
Yeah. And on the world championship front, Christoph, I think we should leave it there. It's such a fascinating topic, and there's so many tentacles in particular this year with the will he or won't he Magnus question overhanging the whole thing. Again, Perpetual Chess will be back on July 12th. Maybe we'll have a little more clarity on these. I mean, we'll be back before then, but we'll be back discussing the candidates on July 12th. Now, before we go, Christoph, so you've got your Triangle Slav with Grandmaster Erwin Lamy coming out next week. Dare I ask, and I know you shared a few pictures online, you're in a beautiful sort of rolling hills / mountain situation in Slovenia. But dare I ask if you're thinking beyond that course as well, as someone who's a fan of all of your Chessable courses?
Yeah, I'm currently working on the one after that already, and also something else, but there's something that will be released probably not in the too distant future, because it's not such a huge course. There will be a smaller course for black on the Sicilian O'Kelly variation.
This
2a6 line, yeah. That was played.
It made a cameo
by...
in the candidates, right?
Exactly.
Didn't someone play it? Yeah.
Rajava played it against
unexpectedly.
Fabiano. That was a bit of a surprise to see that.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's an interesting opening. I'm currently working on that together with a friend and co-author of mine, and I think it's a pretty good surprise weapon. It will be a very compact course. The goal is that it's something that you can learn like over a weekend and then have an interesting surprise weapon. And I think for that purpose, it fits very well. So looking forward to complete that. It should be out this summer, so it's not going to take months. And probably we'll also have something out for Christmas, but that's too early to say, because... And those bigger projects, they need really proper planning, and I don't want to be already announcing it before I know for sure that it's going to happen. So,
right. And just to give one final plug for Christoph's work, again, obviously Chessable is a sponsor of the pod, but I buy Christoph's courses with my own money. I have his Fight Like Magnus course, you know, as a Sveshnikov player myself. Keep It Simple with Black. I've picked up a couple of the lines in the Nimzo-Rogozin course that you did with FM Daniel Barish. And Christoph, your Nimzo-Rogozin course. So, of course, in round three, Alireza and Nakamura played a Nimzo queen c2 line, and it followed the theory in there. So it actually ended up that I was the only game at the point where Alireza sacked a piece on move 17. It was a title Tuesday game that I played. My opponent did not sack a piece. He retreated his bishop. But so when Levy Rosman did a recap video, he was like, and the only game with this position is Ben Johnson. And I was like, well, first of all, there was some luck involved in that, but more importantly, I'm riding on the shoulders of giants because I was a fan of your course. That's why I knew the theory to that point, but I thought that was funny.
Yeah. The tournament had some, definitely some openings that I featured in courses. Yeah. They had many Petrovs, for example, of course.
Yeah, for sure.
And I covered that, and somebody suggested on Twitter that somebody should do something like, play the Petrov like Nippo did. And I already did play the Petrov like Fabi did. Worked very well for him 4 years ago. Yeah, to get this match, and the Petrov is really it's a good opening anyway, and it's very well suited for those events if you are black and you kind of hope that the other side wants to hit the head against a brick wall. It works very well.
As a former E4 player, I don't miss the Petrov.
It's not one of those openings that you're really happy to see. Yeah, that's kind of true, but it's really difficult. Yeah, if you play E4 and you have those like Italian game and Rulo passes, it's kind of a different thing. I mean, a difficult thing for the top players. Not so much for your regular. You will always find your ways and get some play going, but on that level it's really, really difficult sometimes. And I feel some games there have been lost by the desire to play for win in a structure that is actually not really suited to do that. That happened more than once. That Fabiano game that when he had black against Duda, I was kind of, if he really wants to win that badly, why did he play e4 e5 in the first place? I mean, not that this is a drawing weapon, but if you really decide, okay, Duda is somebody I want to win against, play the Caro or something that is not, I'm not asking for a Pirtz or anything like that, but just like do something that doesn't have this total symmetry on the board.
Well said. Well, Christoph, we'll look forward to your course and the O'Kelly and the other ones coming as well. Thank you for interrupting your vacation to share your knowledge and reflections on this somewhat anticlimactic yet lots of stories to talk about tournament. Any closing words, Christoph?
Yeah, I'm looking forward to see the final two rounds. And one thing that I would definitely like to see is a relatively quick development in regards of if this match is happening or what kind of match will be happening. I mean, even if they discuss about a format, they should start right away and not like waste more time because people really
want to know what's happening.
Exactly.
Magnus should be clear about his intentions, hopefully. One way or another. Excellent. Well, thank you, Christoph. It's appreciated as always. You guys can find him on Twitter, find him on Chessable, and we will let you get back to your rustic vacation, Christoph. Thank you.
Thank you, Ben.
Thanks to everyone who helps make Perpetual Chess possible. Big shout out to my producer, Matthew Passy. I'd also like to thank the Blue Wire Podcast Network, with whom we are proud to be affiliated. Be sure to follow us on social media, Beneficial1 on Twitter, at Perpetual Chess on Instagram, or you can join the Perpetual Chess Facebook group. You can email me, ben@perpetualchesspod.com. And of course, last but not least, I'd like to give major thanks to the Perpetual Chess Patreon and PayPal supporters. Those who choose to join that community based on their level of support
can do things like submit questions for guests of the show, have access to live Zoom Q&A lectures with grandmasters who often have appeared on the show, going over chess games, answering questions, stuff like that. And you can even get access to ad-free perpetual chess if that's your preference. So, but most of all, thanks to everyone for listening, and we will catch you all on the next episode.
Podcast Network.